Welcome, everyone, members and guests, to the February 20th program of the City Club of Eugene, Why Tests Are a Poor Lever for School Improvement. Thank you for joining us. Greetings to our broadcast audience, television and radio audiences. I'm Marlene Nesri, City Club President. Our sponsors today are Oregon Country Fair, July 10th, 11th, and 12th, 2015, AARP of Southern Oregon, which believes age and experience can expand one's possibilities, and KLCC. Special thanks go to KPFF Consulting Engineers for supplying our office space, and to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 on Monday nights, and also for archiving our podcasts on their site. Thanks as well to the staff of the Organically Grown Company for hosting teachers and a recent session of our career course, which is a project of City Club, Lane Workforce Partnership, and Lane ESD. We're pleased to welcome two new gold sponsors, Pacific University and Housing and Community Services Agency of Lane County, and our newest individual member, Dee Ward. A quick reminder that we host nearly 50 original nonpartisan programs every year. If you believe with us that civic engagement is the lifeblood of democracy, please do join us. We welcome donors, sponsors, members, volunteers, and students, anyone who has a stake in community life. We also welcome your contributions to our new special events fund. Planning is well underway for our exciting launch this spring, a program with the first female justice of the United States Supreme Court, the Honorable Sandra Day O'Connor. Look for more details in coming weeks and for information about tickets, too. Today's program, Why Tests Are a Poor Lever for School Improvement, is coordinated by former City Club President Mary Layton. She'll introduce our speakers and program.
Today we're going to hear from Jerry Rozek, Associate Professor in the University of Oregon College of Education. He earned his undergraduate degrees in philosophy and physics from Texas A&M University and a PhD in curriculum and teacher education from Stanford. His professional interests have been in qualitative research and the cultural foundations of education, that is, the textures and contexts that give meaning to teaching. His scholarship focuses on understanding teachers' practical knowledge. For example, he's documenting the nature and content of the knowledge that enables teachers to better serve traditionally underserved students. This commitment to promoting social justice in our education system is at the heart of his work. Jerry's recently been named as a Wayne Moore Scholar for 2015-16. The theme of the Wayne Moore Center's work for the next 2 years is the future of public education in the United States. Our schools face numerous challenges: diversion of resources to other programs, inequities in educational opportunities, struggles over curriculum and funding, to name a few. In this presentation, Jerry will describe some of the differences between what we as a community expect of public schools and what tests can measure. When he's finished, our first questioner will be Joy Marshall. Joy founded two chapters of Stand for Children in the Eugene area. Her work has contributed to efforts that won higher standards for child care providers, eliminated soda and junk food from local schools, and earned increases of millions of dollars for school funding. Jerry?
See if I need my glasses. We can do it. So I want to thank the City Club of Eugene for inviting me here today. I'm grateful for the opportunity to offer a few remarks about the role of testing in school reform. I'm also grateful for the more general service provided by the City Club. I'm also grateful for the more general service provided by City Club. This organization represents, in my opinion, the ideal of democratic citizenship. Community members gathering in a town hall format to educate themselves about matters of social policy, to engage in respectful, reasoned dialogue, to consider ideas from multiple perspectives, to listen to differing viewpoints with an open mind on the assumption that doing so promotes creative thinking about the challenges we face as a community and a nation. In an era in which our public discourse has so often been reduced to partisan bickering and willful refusals to hear differing viewpoints, occasions for dialogue like this have become too rare. It is therefore worth pausing to appreciate what we are about to participate in. The dialogue we are about to have is an ancient practice of free exchange of ideas, one on which the vitality of our democratic system of governance arguably depends. I am honored to participate in this process with you. To honor this important occasion, I had planned to offer a critical reflection on the relationship between standardized testing and the concept of curriculum in K-12 schools. It was my thought that before we talk about the influence of testing on student learning, we should talk about actually what is worth learning in our schools. However, as I was preparing my remarks, I received a message from Mary Layton, the representative of the City Club, who contacted me. And she informed me that there had been some recent policy changes here at City Club. Apparently, the National City Club organization had become concerned that City Club audiences are not really learning that much from these talks. Their concern is that these gatherings are more of a social event where people come to see and talk to their friends, but not a lot of learning is taking place. They are worried that City Club presenters are not giving high-quality presentations, and that City Club members are often checking their texts and making their grocery lists while speakers prattle obliviously on about this or that topic. I asked Mary why the National City Club organization had suddenly become so worried about such things, and she reported that they were good folks, but the national organization gets funding from federal grants, and that there are some senators who think City Club is a waste of money. Or perhaps they don't support City Club's goals. They're insisting on some accountability for how City Club organizations across the country actually produce the outcomes they say they are. So in the interest of being a good team player, I worked with Mary to design a way to document what is learned here today. Also, I'm a teacher. I'm a professor of education. I take the craft of teaching seriously. I want you to get something out of my remarks today, and I want to help City Club document the good educational work that it does. So Mary and I put a plan together. I plan to provide a brief and hopefully engaging talk that illustrates the problematic relationship between curriculum and testing. And this would be followed by a short assessment exercise in which each of you would be asked to describe the relationship between curriculum and testing in schools when we were done. You would write your answers on a form we would provide, and your responses would be graded after the talk. We sent this assessment plan to the national organization, and they said it was not a rigorous enough assessment. The relationship between testing and curriculum is not agreed upon by experts, they pointed out, so there could be no clear standard of right or wrong for answers on this assessment. A more definitive proof of learning was needed for critics of City Club to be satisfied. Therefore, the national organization recommended focusing on ideas about which there is a clear consensus and for which learning outcomes could be more easily measured. Their research revealed that people often lacked basic literacy skills related to the topic of curriculum. In other words, people often misspell the word curriculum. They asked that we spend some of our instructional time today teaching you to spell the word curriculum correctly, then giving a spelling test at the end of the presentation. They actually sent me a script I could use to teach with, which I will use now. So if you would repeat after me, we're going to spell the word curriculum. C.
C.
U.
U.
R.
R.
R. You are such good students. Okay, so you can relax. There will be no test at the end of my talk. I made all that up. There's no mandate for testing coming down from the National City Club organization. I have no idea if there even is a National City Club organization. However, some version of what I just described has been occurring within our public schools for almost 3 decades. Our schools, of course, need to teach basic skills. For example, our students should learn how to spell the word curriculum. But we need them to learn many of the things that are listed in the mission statement of the City Club. We need schools to foster complex critical thinking skills. We need them to prepare open-minded, creative problem solvers, people who can look at issues from many perspectives so they can function as democratic citizens. Unfortunately, the gradual emergence of an audit culture in public schools, an obsession with measuring educational outcomes so we can prove educational time and resources are being used well, increasingly hinders the effort to teach these things. In what remains of my remarks, I will outline the way a contemporary focus on standardized testing is narrowing our conception of curriculum. The remedy for this is not more sophisticated standardized tests. I will offer instead it is to reconsider the use of standardized tests as a driver for school improvement altogether. So what is curriculum? Curriculum is a word we use to refer to what is taught in school. Curriculum is the purpose of school. It is the reason we turn our children over to others for 6 to 7 hours a day for most of the year. There are many common sense notions of what curriculum is or should be. There are narrow views, such as the idea that schools teach only reading, writing, and arithmetic. There are equally common sense notions that schools should teach qualities of character. This view persists most strongly in our conceptions of athletics, where it is commonly understood that to be a character, which is commonly understood to be a character building experience. But there is hardly a popular culture representation of teaching that does not present a teacher guiding a student on a process of self-discovery where they learn through hard work and persistence all that they can become. Within the scholarship and research on curriculum, we see documentation of even more variation. I will briefly review some of the widely circulated conceptions of curriculum, from the broadest levels to the most narrow. First, we might talk about the mandated curriculum. This is the curriculum content that is mandated by the state, a school board, or some other official governing body. The Common Core standards are one example of a mandated curriculum. Within the scope of a mandated curriculum, you can find the published curriculum. Textbooks are often aligned with mandated curriculum, but they don't often cover all the material in the mandated curriculum, or they do not cover all of it with equal emphasis. Slightly more narrow in scope is the planned curriculum. How many teachers do we have in the audience? All right, so I'm going to get some witnesses here. Slightly more narrow in scope is the planned curriculum. The planned curriculum is what teachers actually plan to teach. Often the mandated curriculum includes more than can be taught in a year. The planned curriculum is shaped by the mandated curriculum. It is also influenced by the published curriculum, the textbooks available to the teacher. The planned curriculum is also influenced by a teacher's knowledge base. Teachers cannot teach what they don't know and don't know how to teach. This is why investments in teacher professional development are so essential to any curriculum reform effort. Then there is the taught or enacted curriculum. A teacher doesn't always teach exactly what they plan to teach. Sometimes time runs out and a teacher doesn't get to teach everything they plan to. Sometimes a lesson takes an unexpected turn and what is taught ends up looking very different from what is planned. More narrow still is the learned curriculum. Students don't always learn what is taught. For example, there is the intended learning, the things that students learn that teachers intended to teach, which is usually not everything they plan to teach. There's unintended learning, the things that students learn that teachers didn't intend to teach. For example, when teaching a computer-based math lesson, students might end up learning more about the computer interface than they do about the math. Then there's the hidden curriculum, the implicit messages that schools teach children. 50 years ago, Philip Jackson famously documented the way schools teach things like when to be silent, deference to authority, conformity to a regimented schedule, how to repeat after me when I ask you to spell a word. In my own work, I have documented how racial segregation in schools teaches students about their relative worth in society, about their future, and about the possibility of social hope. And then, at the most narrow level, there is the assessed curriculum, those aspects of learning that we test and measure. One thing we know is that there are many more types of curriculum being taught in schools than even our most comprehensive systems of assessment can document. Among the types of learning going on that it is difficult to measure are, as I mentioned before, character education, education for creativity, the ability to question foundational assumptions, the ability to look at things from multiple perspectives. Even things as allegedly simple and essential as reading comprehension are famously difficult to document. My colleague at the University of Oregon, Dr. Gina Bianca-Rosa, for example, is working on an ingenious assessment of reading comprehension. This assessment presents students with reading samples that have mistakes in the storyline. So at some point a word is used wrong or a concept turns in a way that you wouldn't expect and doesn't make sense in the story. Then they ask the student to read these aloud, and they measure the speech delays when the student reads the mistake. So if the child slows down at the mistake, that means they comprehend the mistake. Right? However, if they move on through, that means they're just reading mechanically, and their comprehension is low. So this is a really good way to measure comprehension. Unfortunately, it is costly to undertake, and we could never afford to apply this kind of assessment to every elementary child in the country. Right? So even when there are assessments that would work, sometimes they're not scalable. So we assess what we can, but we need to teach more than we widely assess because our assessment technology has not and likely will not catch up and scale up to cover everything and everyone we need to teach. Given that caveat about the limitations of assessment, it is worth noting that there are many different types of assessment, some more flexible and robust, and others more narrow and inflexible. For example, there are formative versus summative assessments. Formative assessments are undertaken during the course of teaching to improve instructional practice on the spot. Summative assessments are undertaken at the end of a process of teaching to ascertain its relative success or failure. There's informal versus formal modes of assessment. Informal assessments are happening constantly. In this debate, it's not a question of whether we should do assessments or not in schools. Everybody knows assessment is important to do in schools. The question is what type of assessments and what the effects of these assessments are. So informal assessments are happening all the time. A teacher walks by the table, looks at what a student is writing, and then asks them, well, how did you get that answer? Right? Or a teacher walks by a chemistry lab and watches a group of students working together and hears their conversation and pays attention and can assess by listening to their conversation whether they're actually understanding the basic underlying dynamics of molecular chemistry. Then there's formal modes of assessment where teachers or someone else design an assessment tool to measure a particular form of learning. Within the category of formal assessments, there are many types. There are authentic assessments, in which students are asked to apply their knowledge to a real-world problem or task in order to reveal whether they actually have integrated that knowledge in a deep way. There are interviews. Teachers can sit down and talk and ask, either structured or unstructured interviews, and discern in that way whether a student has understood something that's been taught. There are essay exams, where students write and explain their knowledge about a topic. There are presentations where they present their knowledge to parents, to the teacher, to other students, and based on that presentation, we can assess what they know about something. There are portfolio approaches to assessments, in which students are invited to provide multiple modes of documentation of their understanding of what they have learned. And then there are the assessments that many of us are most familiar with, multiple choice quizzes, fill-in-the-blank test, which have their purpose. They are the narrowest in what they measure, but they are the cheapest and most definitive forms of assessment available. It's the easy; they require the least amount of human interpretation to evaluate. So those are all the different modes of assessment that are available to us, and most of them don't get talked about in our public conversations about assessment. Finally, there are many modes of implementation of assessment. You can have low-stakes or high-stakes assessments. Low-stakes assessments mean what you get out of the assessment is the information the assessment provides. And there are high-stakes assessments where some opportunity or some consequence follows for the student, for the teacher, or the school, depending on the outcomes of the assessment. There are optional versus mandatory assessments. That's a self-explanatory term. And then there are non-standardized versus standardized assessments. Now, it is generally, when I teach assessment in my teacher education programs, one of the things that we underline for teachers when they develop assessments is you should only assess what you've taught students. Because the pedagogical value of an assessment is A, that it assesses what you've taught a student, and B, that it be given to the student, the results be given to the student as soon as possible. If you engage in an assessment and then give the student the assessment 3 weeks later, right, the value of that assessment is almost nil. It really needs to come back as soon as possible so the student can actually use it as a critical form of feedback to reconstruct their knowledge of something. So standardized tests, non-standardized tests can do that because the teacher can create an assessment that actually fits what they've been teaching and go through the assessment process on the spot and give it back to the student fairly quickly. And I know we have classes of 50 now, so maybe on the spot means a day later or 2 days later, sometimes longer. But standardized assessments rarely do these two things because they're not designed primarily to enhance instruction in the class. Standardized tests are mainly managerial tools. They're used for institutional management purposes to compare entire schools or districts to other schools and districts. So for example, the Smarter Balance test that's coming through will be offered in the spring, but the results won't be provided to the students fully until August when they're already out of the classroom and with another teacher. Right, so the primary purpose of standardized tests is to compare students across large groups, not to enhance instruction in situ. It is high stakes, mandatory, standardized tests that rely predominantly on the cheapest and narrowest forms of assessment, such as multiple choice questions, that are currently being used in our schools and that most of the current controversy is about. There are many other forms of assessment we could be using. So this inventory of curriculum and assessment types should make a couple of things clear. First, The curriculum we expect schools to teach, and that they in fact do teach, takes a wide range of forms and includes a wide range of outcomes. Second, the range of curricular outcomes we regularly and reasonably expect students to teach, schools to teach, far exceeds the learning outcomes that we can measure. The curriculum outcomes we expect schools to teach certainly exceed the learning outcomes that can be measured by the narrow assessment technologies we can afford to mass produce and use on a systemic scale. All right. So if we consent to that for a moment, this latter issue, the fact that assessments can't measure everything that we need to teach, is still not a problem. It's not really a problem because as long as the appropriate relationship between curriculum and assessment remains intact. Curriculum, what we think needs to be taught, needs to be determined first. We decide what we need to teach, and we use assessments as a mean to make sure that we are making some progress, at least to some of those goals. In that way, assessments are used to help us monitor progress towards some of our goals. But we put curriculum content first, that means acknowledging that there are components of curriculum that we cannot assess or cannot assess well, but that they are nonetheless valuable and important and therefore require our commitment and our investment. But somehow, over the last three decades, the relationship between assessment and curriculum has become inverted. Things have been turned on their heads. A constant rhetoric of budget crisis has been combined with a rhetoric of distrust in schools and teachers. As a result, educational improvement efforts have shifted from a focus on investing in better materials and teacher education as a means of improving content delivery to a focus on accountability measures that involve the use of high-stakes, mandatory, standardized tests to punitively motivate teachers and schools to do better with what they have. Combined with reduced funding, which has led to larger class sizes, and less professional development for teachers, this punitive approach to school reform seems unlikely to achieve the improvements it seeks. But this is not the biggest problem. The bigger problem is how these assessment-centered approaches to reform actually reduce the effectiveness of schools. That's what I want to talk about and what remains. So what gets lost? Let's look at some of the casualties. Over the last 30 years, the rise of a test-centered culture in our schools has compelled schools to reduce and sometimes eliminate physical education curriculum, music curriculum, art curriculum, science curriculum in the early grades, and social studies curriculum in the early grades. It has also led to a narrowing of the range of learning in subject areas still receiving emphasis. In early literacy education, phonemic decoding receives more emphasis than comprehension, in part because it is more easily measured. Mathematical computation skills receive more emphasis than mathematical problem solving in many schools. Though I have to say 4J has done some good work resisting the trend in the elementary grades. In part, and thanks to the good work of my UO colleague, Dr. Jill Baxter, and all the people she works with in 4J. This exclusion of what used to be considered core content has become normalized in school communities. Nobody's surprised that we don't have art classes anymore. We don't even argue about it. So much so that among the parents I associate with, we take for granted, I have an 8-year-old at Edison Elementary School, so I have a third grader getting ready to take the Smarter Balance test. So much so is this the case that we've normalized it in our school communities. We take for granted that we will have to find extracurricular means of helping our children develop physical literacy, learn music, experience artistic creativity, and get exposed to scientific concepts and inquiry at an early age. Our generation of parents is often caricatured as overscheduling our children and are often diagnosed as being overly competitive as a result. But if you consider the gradual reduction in curriculum being offered at schools, the cutting of things that most of us think are important components of a child's education, then this increased enrollment in organized extracurricular activities is not an expression of some parent pathology. It is a reasonable response to reduced educational service by public schools. In an effort to hold schools more accountable, this over-reliance on tests as a driver of reform actually pushes things out of the curriculum and ends up making schools accountable for less learning, not accountable for more learning. The advocates for these tests will often object that this narrowing of a curriculum is not the intention of standardized assessment systems. But in the end, intentions don't matter. The actual effects matter. And these are the effects. So what can be done? Advocates for the test will quickly offer that the problem is that the old tests are bad and that what we need are new tests. Here in Oregon, that means the old Oaks test was bad and we need the new Smarter Balance test. The solution to a dysfunctional testing system always seems to be a new test. The question we need to be asking, in my professional opinion, is why do we need these kind of high-stakes standardized tests at all? Note, I'm not saying why do we need assessments at all. Why do we need high-stakes, mandatory, standardized assessments? That's a very specific question. The good news is that there are signs all over the country that the tide is turning against the use of these standardized test-driven conceptions of educational improvement. There is a nationwide grassroots parental opt-out movement that has been growing for the past 5 years and has recently achieved a critical mass in many districts across the nation. Nearly every state has provisions in its laws that allow parents to opt their children out of standardized tests. Oregon has such provisions. Parents are taking advantage of these provisions in increasingly large numbers. For those who are interested, 4J School District has recently posted an easy-to-fill-out opt-out form on its website, and you can find a copy by Googling Eugene Parents Concerned About Teaching. A link to the form is posted on that page. If you're interested in becoming part of the movement, you can also Google an organization called the Community Alliance for Public Education, or CAPE, and this is a group of teachers, parents, retired teachers, former administrators, and other people concerned about education who have organized speakers to come educate the public about these topics. This parent movement has been joined by individual teachers and principals of conscience, as well as by both teachers' unions, the Association of Supervision and Curriculum Development, a professional organization for school administrators, the president of the National Parent Teacher Organization, over 1,000 educational scholars who signed a statement encouraging Congress to repeal the emphasis on standardized tests when it considers reauthorizing the No Child Left Behind Act later this month, and even, this is sounds little, but it's big, even the American Statistical Association, a relatively apolitical body of mathematicians, really, issued a rare public press release declaring that the intended use of the Smarter Balance test was scientifically invalid for measuring the quality of schools or teachers. I mean, if they're getting off the bench, you know, something's happening. At root, what will be needed is a renewal of trust in schools and teachers. Over the last 3 decades, there's been a gradual withdrawal of trust in schools and teachers, and instead we have put our faith and trust in high-stakes, mandatory, standardized tests that use the narrowest measures of student learning as a means of school improvement. What parents and others are now seeing is that these tests have let us down. Our faith in them has been misplaced. It is important to remember that this obsession with high-stakes, mandatory, standardized testing is a recent development. It hasn't always been like this, and it need not continue to be so. Ultimately, redirecting this dysfunctional educational policy discourse will require all of us to insist on something better for our children. We can do this. There are signs that we are doing it. And when we do, we will be able to educate a generation of students more broadly. We will be able to move beyond a focus on narrow testable skills and recommit to teaching critical thinking, the ability to appreciate multiple perspectives on issues, and the ability to creatively solve problems. In short, the next generation of students will be prepared to take their place in an organization like City Club and take part in the ancient democratic practice of a free exchange of ideas that supports our democracy, a practice that I remain very honored to be participating with you today. Thank you.
And now here's Joy Marshall from Stanford Children, who will ask the first question.
Hi, thank you for this opportunity. I'm Joy Marshall. I'm a City Club member. I was lapsed, but now I'm a real City Club member, and I'm also a 4J parent, and I work for Stanford Children. And thank you for your talk today. Thank you for being here. I think that I agree with a lot of what you say. I have a real different perspective, though, on a lot of it, and so I hear that City Club is going to have another program so we can hear some other perspectives, because I think that's important. This is just one perspective. And I can think I have a couple minutes, right, to give a little context. Just 2 minutes. Okay. Whoa, it's going to be quick. I'm going to talk fast. So I have 3 points. The first one is I think that we need to ratchet down the whole dialogue. I have a friend who is very political. She probably agrees with a lot of what you said as well. But she said, boy, this dialogue is becoming too shrill, and we can't hear each other. So I'd really like us just to think, okay, these are tests that are given once a year. They're given in 7 of the 13 years that our kids are in public school, and they're given for a few hours. It's about 7 hours of testing, and it's one source of measurement. Now, if we need to lower the pressure on the test, I think that's a reasonable suggestion. Well, let's have a reasonable dialogue about it, but let's not accuse people who disagree of bad faith, which is kind of what's happening to some of us. And I just want to say my daughter, who goes to a local public high school, came home the other day and said, "Mom, our teacher told us we're going to have to take a test that 70% of the kids are going to fail, and we shouldn't have to take it." I was like, "What?" And I talked with her, and her teacher basically has been pushing the students to tell their parents that they should opt out. My kid was so upset and so stressed by that. So I haven't talked to the teacher about it yet. I imagine the teachers are feeling pretty stressed about it too, but it's impacting our kids. It's not okay. Let's present the kind of civil, thoughtful role model of dialogue that we would like our kids to exhibit. I also want to say that data is good, and this should be one form of data. There is, you know, I talked with a parent recently who said, "I'm opting my kid out." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because we're failing our kids of color." And she is a student of color, so I imagine she knows. And I don't disagree with that, right? But I said to her, "How do you know? How do you know we're failing our students of color?" And she said, "Everybody knows." I'm like, "You know what? Anecdotal opinion is no substitute for real numbers, and you're only going to get those real numbers if we have the standardized data. It should not be held as the most important thing in the world. Obviously, it has to have its place. But there's no way we're going to know if our kids are at grade level. And when I talk with parents of every socioeconomic level and I say, "Do you want to know if your kids at your school are at grade level?" They want to know. So there's a place for this data. It's important. And my last quick story, and then my question, is I was at the state capitol Monday and talking with legislators, and we had a group of 12 foreign exchange students from different countries. And at one point, the state senator turned to them and said, "What do you think of American high schools? They're all going to high school here." And all the kids froze and looked down at the ground, and nobody wanted to talk. And the senator said, "What's up? Please tell us." And one brave young woman said, "Well, your schools are too easy here." And the senator said, "Do you all feel that?" And all 12 students looked up and they nodded their heads. And they said, then they started to talk. They said, "Your schools are so easy. Your high schools we're shocked. We're surprised. Our schools are more rigorous. Our testing is more rigorous. We had no idea it was going to be like this." So I'm saying to you, these are the kids. This is the reality of the world, is our kids we have to raise the bar for our kids. We have to be more accountable for our kids. Because in this world, if a kid doesn't graduate high school and probably get education beyond that, they are going to be stuck in low-wage jobs and itinerant unemployment. That is the future they're facing. So this is our responsibility, especially to kids of color, especially to poor kids, to give them a more rigorous bar. So my question to you, sorry, I said I could have a little background. So my question is, how do you know if you don't have that comparable data? Then it just becomes everybody's own individual test. How do we really know how our kids are doing? And anyway, thank you. That's it.
Thank you for that question. And thank you for your good work advocating for quality education. I have some respect for the Stanford Children Organization. So I'll just direct my response to the question that was asked. It's a good question, how do we know? And I think that's part of the point of the remarks I was trying to make, is that we know how to measure some kind of learning outcomes, and we don't know how to measure others. And we don't know how to measure others, some others, on a scalable level. So in the interest to have broad comparable data, I think we need to really rigorously ask not just how might we know because we're panicked that our children might somehow be left behind, that we're moving and responding out of a space of fear, right, to make sure that we get something that we feel we're losing, right, and take a deep breath and ask whether we actually have evidence that we're losing this. Later this month, actually on March 31st, I believe it is that right? Professor Yang Zhao from the University of Oregon, who has written a book, he analyzes how the U.S. tends to compare itself to China, and its educational system. And the basis of those comparisons are almost always the outcomes on the standardized, the international standardized tests, and how the U.S. always looks like it's falling behind. But he provides a book-length critical interrogation of why would we want to emulate the Chinese educational system when it doesn't produce any of the results that historically the U.S. educational system has presented all along. We wouldn't want to aspire to their system of governance. We wouldn't want to aspire to their cultural norms. We are a different community, and using the test scores as the only source of data that you would use to decide whether you want to emulate another country's, a nation state's educational system is a very, very poor form of reasoning. You need to look at all of the effects of a certain kind of educational system, not just its test scores. And he says, and when you look at it that way, you'll see that you don't want to emulate that system. And he says, we've produced great engineers, Nobel Prize-winning scientists. We have led the world technologically, et cetera. So he leads a very sort of empirically broad argument that there's no reason to be concerned about that comparison just because of some test scores, because test scores measure a very narrow swath of what is important to learn. And he says, and we're in danger, if we continue with this obsession, of actually achieving what we want, which is emulating the Chinese educational system, and we will get the same results, and he said that would be bad for our nation state. So I encourage you on March 31st to come out to the Ford Alumni Center. We'll be putting up some advertising about this pretty soon, and come hear Yung Zhao talk about that in more detail. I think the basic answer is, how much do you trust these tests to be measuring all the things that we need, to be teaching students? Certainly data is good. And I think Joy said at the beginning, maybe we need to ratchet down the pressure on these. Right? Maybe we need to ratchet down the pressure. The problem with the assessments is not the assessment itself. It's that they are high stakes, mandatory, and standardized. Right? When you combine those three adjectives in front of an assessment, they have pernicious effects. They are not just affecting the schools one day out of the year. They are affecting the schools all year long, because teachers and administrators are having to think about their school rating, they're having to think about how they can prepare students for those tests, and when they start worrying about the consequences for those high-stakes tests, then they start pushing other types of curriculum out of the way. I would have almost no critique of the use of these standardized tests if they were not so high-stakes. I might still have some critique. Because I'm not really sure what value is added by these comparisons across nation states and even across states in the United States. We can identify knowledge we want to learn and have criterion referenced assessments. Like, has somebody learned physics adequately? Have they learned how to write a five-paragraph essay adequately? I mean, we can assess those things without deciding whether we need to compare ourselves to Massachusetts or not. Teachers are doing those kind of assessments on the fly all the time. I always learn more talking to my daughter's teacher about what she's learning than I learn by picking up the test scores that she gets. But sure, we can have more data. But when one form of data and one form of assessment reconfigures the whole school year, it doesn't just reconfigure that day, but reconfigures the entire school year and the entire profession and all the course offerings we make to students, that's a problem that needs to be reflected on.
Thank you so much. We'll break for a few minutes now and have audience members come up with their questions.
You're listening to KLCC NPR for Oregonians in Eugene, 89.7 FM KLCC, KLCO Newport, 90.5, KLFR Reedsport, 89.1, and at 88.1, KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet.
Welcome back to the February 20th City Club program, Why Tests Are a Poor Lever for School Improvement. City Club members, please identify yourselves and keep your questions to about 30 seconds each. Thank you.
I'm Jane Elliott. I'm an organizational member through the Oregon Country Fair and a retired teacher. And our table was interested in knowing whether teacher evaluations are pegged to test scores here in Oregon yet, and what you know about other states, and whether school evaluations and district evaluations are tied to these tests.
Okay, thank you. First off, thank you for your work on Country Fair. I have enjoyed it.
Good.
So this year, we are seeing the implementation of two major Common Core aligned testing systems that are new. Here in Oregon, we're implementing the Smarter Balance Test, which is otherwise known as the Smarter Balanced Assessment Coalitions Test. And it's a coalition of states on the West Coast, essentially, who are implementing this test. And then there's the PARC coalition. I don't remember exactly what PARC stands for, but essentially that's the East Coast version of this. Originally, the goal was to have all 50 states participating in these Common Core aligned assessments. And at the high point, they had 45 states signed on to one or the other of these. And at this point, that number has reduced to 31. Some states have pulled out. Some states have reduced their commitment to the use of the tests in some way or another. So the tests are being implemented. And the philosophy underlying the test is that the tests will be used not primarily to assess individual student progress, but to assess teacher quality and school quality. The teacher quality is new. In the past, No Child Behind has insisted that schools has required schools be rated on a five-point system. But the Smarter Balance and the PARC tests were designed to also allow what's called value-added modeling, to track whether a teacher has added value to a child's education over subsequent years. This is the part of the test that the American Statistical Association has declared scientifically invalid, and that most of my fellow colleagues who are specialists in assessment consider deeply problematic, mainly because a teacher isn't in control of all the factors affecting a student's learning, right? So this is what's really high stakes about the test. So the question is whether these tests have consequences for teachers and for schools. So as of this point, there are a few consequences for schools. The school's ratings on a five-point ranking will be determined by the students' scores on these tests, and to a lesser extent by their participation in the test. Now, recently, 2 years ago, Oregon got a waiver so that the No Child Behind laws that require specific types of consequences for the schools, they got a waiver for those consequences. So consequences have been drastically reduced for Oregon. They're one of 41 states that have a waiver. So almost all states have a waiver on the No Child Behind consequences. Secondly, Nancy Golden, the chief education officer for the state of Oregon, has recently presented a report to the governor's office suggesting that any consequences and any ratings, actually, for the schools and for teachers based on the Smarter Balance tests would be put off for at least 1 year, because the anticipation is that 60-70% of the students are going to fail this test, and that it's a new test, so it wouldn't really be fair to assess teachers or schools based on this new test. So it looks like that recommendation will probably be accepted. So I think in the very near term, for next year, there's not a lot at stake for the test performance. But in principle, nobody has backed away yet from the idea that these tests would eventually be used to assess teacher quality and school quality.
I'm Jack Marietta. I had a question about if you have an opinion on the matter, the content, the curriculum of the Common Core rather than just the assessment of it. Is it the right way to go? Is it an improvement over anything in the past?
So this is a, I guess I would say yes, it's an improvement on past national standards, in my opinion, if you believe national standards are the way to go for organizing school improvement. What I think is better about it is that the test is attempting to emphasize a broader range of thinking skills, more critical thinking skills, not information, not just computation. So that's when I was teaching, I would have liked to have seen and used some of the content that is advocated for in the Common Core. However, there are more profound questions to be asked about whether we need to have a standardized national Common Core content in schools, or whether that the idea of a Common Core should be a flexible Common Core where communities can draw. Because the fact is, our nation has produced versions of a Common Core, a set of national standards, sets of state standards, over and over again for the last 50 years. And it rockets back and forth between putting a bunch of subject matter experts, English professors and math professors, in a room together, and they create a wish list of all the things they want college freshmen to understand. and there is no way that high schools can actually achieve this. And then this swings back to a sort of more condensed version of standards, and then the people get frustrated that's not ambitious enough, and they move back in this direction. This has happened over and over again for 50 years, and the Common Core national standards are one more iteration of this. And I think there are legitimate conversations to be had about whether we need national standards or not. I was a math teacher. There are things about math that I consider universal. It doesn't matter if you're in Idaho or whether you're in Texas. You know, we could probably agree that there are some things everybody needs to know. But there are other aspects of learning where that's not the case, and the current Common Core doesn't adequately acknowledge that, in my opinion.
I'm Paul Thompson, a City Club member on and off over the last decade or so. One of the points that you made in your presentation was that we need to renew our trust in teachers. Mm-hmm. And presumably that would translate into restoring them their kind of central role in making the assessment if we trust them. Mm-hmm. So what we'd like to hear is maybe one or two specific things which are the most important things to do to renew this trust and therefore translate them into the role of making the assessments.
That's a great question. First, I think sort of civically, we need to recognize what we've been doing for the last 10 to 20 years, which is we've been allowing the conversation to center around a distrust or a critique of whether schools are prepared to teach the way we want them to, and then sort of tacitly putting our faith and trust in high-stakes mandatory standardized assessments to be the kind of input we're willing to listen to, not the input we're getting from professional organizations of teachers and from administrators, et cetera. So at some level, we have to question ourselves and realize that it's not a matter of trusting or not trusting the teachers. We have to trust somebody, right? We have to rely on something to engage with the schools. So let's. So the question is, do you rely on your teacher in a conversation and establish a relationship with the teacher or an imperfect standardized assessment? And I prefer the idea of having a of relying on the relationship and the conversation with the professional teacher that cares for my child all these hours every week, every month, 9 months out of the year. But in answer to your question, what we could do, part of what we're doing is we're creating conditions under which it's difficult for teachers to actually do the things that we rely on them to do. We're increasing class size, right? And so what I really need is class sizes to be smaller so that the teacher can actually have more time to pay attention to my daughter's education, right? So that I can actually rely on her judgment, right? So when the teacher is teaching 50 kids in an eighth grade class, it is very difficult. I walk into the class with the teacher and she might say, "Who?" Right? You know, my daughter's quiet. So we're setting up teachers for failure, and then we're acting as if the failure is a characteristic of the teacher and the professional themselves, as opposed to a characteristic of the context that we've created as citizens, right? We're defunding education. This requires us to go through a thinking process. That's why conversations like this are so important. The tests themselves aren't actually the problem. It's this underlying rhetoric of distrust and disinvestment in schools. So I think what we need to do, reduce class sizes and invest in more professional development for teachers. So if I had a teacher who had more professional development and more time to think about their practice and had a smaller class size, I would have no problem trusting their judgment about how well my child is doing. So,
James Baldock, City Club member since 2012. You may have partially answered my question, but our table was wondering if the we know that there are good schools and there are bad schools, but actually quantifying how they're good or bad, that's where the tricky gray area goes. And so if these tests are, as you've said, are very poor at quantifying a good school or bad school, what's an alternative method that you propose we could use instead of these, you know, testing these tests?
So I'm not opposed to using standardized tests as one source of data in assessing schools. What I'm concerned about is they become the exclusive measure. Right? If I were to go in and try and figure out whether I wanted to have my daughter in a school, I might look at their ratings. I might go look at the test scores. I would also look at the demography of the school, right, and ask who the school is serving, right? I would look for not just the immediate score they have, but I would look for how students' outcomes change over time, longitudinally, right? Not just whether a student moved into the district, had a bad score, and moved out. I would talk to the teachers. I would look at the curriculum. I would use essentially a portfolio-based assessment of the school to get a picture of how well the school is doing and realize that there is no one single numerical standard upon which I can rely to gauge all the things that a school is doing. So I think the answer is not to do the test, but to look at multiple and triangulate your data across multiple sources, and then to not make the test high stakes. Right? Because what you have is a punitive system whereby if a school continues to score low on these tests, then there are punitive measures directed at the schools, as opposed to if you want a school to be better, you need to invest in professional development, right, that is probably tailored to the needs of that community, not imposed from a very great remove. Right? So those are I would remove the high stakes from the test and keep the data, and then I would look at other sources of data.
Randy Prince, City Club member. Your talk has been very informative about this generation of tests that began, say, with the New Child Left Behind. In Oregon, we had the Oaks test and these Smarter Balance, something that superseded other tests, maybe good for their purpose, like scholastic aptitude, or perhaps culturally biased or not exactly testing on what was taught. But even this new generation of tests, it makes me wonder about something else new that I learned about in the College of Education here, this concept of multiple intelligences. How well does that understanding that we have now, that people inherently are sort of in different ways, their mental aptitude may be slanted different ways, and we have to sort of honor that and adjust our teaching to people whose verbal linguistic, sitting in a chair listening to words and writing things down, is maybe not their strongest point, that we have to give them the chance to work on their strengths before we, you know. Does this generation of tests do any better, or does it do anything really to help us deliver education that honors the different aptitudes of students and their different, you know, whether they have an inherent musical or graphic ability compared to just the old traditional mental faculties that teachers, of course, are strongest and curriculum writers?
That's a great question. I think that the new tests are probably an improvement upon the old tests, the Oaks. I think they do try to emphasize some critical thinking skills and some things that aren't included in previous tests. But they don't go nearly far enough. They look very similar to the previous tests. They remain high stakes, mandatory, and standardized, and therefore have all the same narrowing effects. There's no music on these new tests. There's no creative thinking assessments on these new tests. All those things remain excluded, and because they're high stakes, that means those types of learning outcomes will remain underemphasized in our public schools as long as we're using them. So my concern is I like multiple forms of data, and I think these tests arguably are a little bit more ambitious in what they try to measure. But not, they still premise on the idea that the only teaching that matters is that which can be assessed. I don't think the people writing it believe that, but in effect, the nature of the policy, it has that effect. And so, yeah, I do think there's reasonable people believe this is an improvement. And I don't think they're wrong. I just don't think it's enough of an improvement. And I don't think we should operate in our educational conversations with the assumption that we have to have these tests as the primary driver of improvement. So that's what I would say.
George Russell, City Club member since 1992. And I'm asking this question for City Club guest Roscoe Kern. And the question is, can you address the possible financial motives that some corporations and politicians might have in strongly promoting high stakes, mandatory standardized tests?
Good to see you, George. And thank you, Roscoe. So in most of my public conversations about this, I try to stay away from the broader, I don't want to call it conspiracy theories, because they're not just theories. There really probably are profiteering going on in our educational system. I don't doubt that. I don't think the critique of the test requires you to buy into the idea that there's somebody out there diabolically trying to hijack our school system just to make a dollar for themselves. So I don't believe that's necessary for us to actually have a conversation about why these tests should be reconsidered. That being said, there are clearly a handful of corporations that profit greatly from publishing both tests and educational materials, and they use those profits then to lobby the government for these policies. Now, maybe they're all innocent. maybe they all have the interest of my daughter centrally at heart. I think that's a naive view. One of the things that strikes me, I mean, people like to talk about Pearson as a publishing company, and I think Pearson is deeply problematic in the way in which it sort of seeks to influence the educational system. But there's another thing to look at. When I was a grad student, I was really aware, it was very explicit, a Microsoft corporation was attempting to, was basically lobbying to make computers a necessary part of curriculum in all schools. That in order to learn, instead of having textbooks, you're going to have laptops. And this was going to be, they weren't ever successful at this, because the actual work of a classroom tends to be hands-on and relational between a teacher and a student, and laptops never really kind of moved into the space. And this was a frustration, because it's a huge market. Right? If they could get schools to buy in the idea they have to have laptops for every child and replace them every 3 years, this is an enormous market. And then do that in other nation states. What's happening now is they've moved that over to requiring the tests to be computer-based. So if this actually gets implemented on a large scale, eventually schools are going to have computers for every child just to implement the tests. So it's another means of getting computers in and requiring our educational resources to be spent on technology, and then they would have to be replaced every 3 years, then the software has to be bought to do the tests. So there's clearly a profit motive behind that. Do I believe that almost everybody I talk to in the educational system who supports this is somehow secretly in the employ of Pearson? No, I don't. I believe really reasonable people think this test can be useful, and they go, oh, yeah, the profit motive, whatever. We're in a capitalist society. Let's do it. But there is a profit motive involved here, and our systems of governance, right, actually are in various ways at times our discourse is distorted by that. And I think the information we're getting about these tests are primarily coming from the people who are selling the tests. And there are very few opportunities like this to have conversations where we can have alternative narratives about it. And so that would be my account about it.
Hi, Jerry. Zelda Lopez Otto here, LULAC member, City Club since, I believe, 2012. My question is from Larry Lewin, 4J teacher who's retired. It says, Rob Saxon, Oregon Department of Education, said at North Eugene High School that our state will spend $18 million on smarter balance tests. Mm-hmm. What other use of these funds would you recommend?
Man, get a list. First off, that money could easily be two things. Spend that money on teacher professional development. Right? We have good curriculum. Help teachers be more prepared to teach it. And then take the tests away and use that instructional time to actually teach content, right? So teach content as opposed to use times preparing for the test, preparing to learn how to keyboard, preparing to learn how to use the software for the assessment. So the one thing we know actually improves educational outcomes is time on task, is actually learning and engaging the content. We've known this for a long time. So the more time we have students engaged in learning, the better. The more time we take them away from that and have them do other things, like take tests and prepare for the tests, then we have a problem. And then I would take that money. Keep in mind that the money used for the tests is small compared to what it would take to reduce class sizes. Right? Class sizes are personnel, and personnel are more expensive than tests. I believe we need to reduce class sizes. And one of the appeals of the use of accountability rhetorics in testing is that it's the cheap way to convince ourselves we're doing something good. But it's not effective. If we had to get to the moon to save our children's well-being, and somebody said, well, a rocket's too expensive, let's just use a slingshot. You can use a slingshot all you want, but you're not going to actually ever get to the moon. You're going to have to build the rocket. We're going to have to invest in schools, and we're going to have to invest in the personnel. We should have elementary schools with class sizes of 20, and we should have high schools with class sizes of 25 at the most.
Thank you. We've run out of time. Thank you very much for bringing clarity and vision to this complicated and urgent topic. We'll meet again next Friday on February the 27th at the Downtown Athletic Club for a human rights view of fracking with guest speaker Tom Kearns. Thanks again to our sponsors, Oregon Country Fair, AARP of Southern Oregon, and KLCC. Thank you so much.